Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the November 2nd, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, you're tuned in to a one-hour broadcast about our nation's space program, no matter what the topic is. If it's going up, coming down, or just happening in space, this is the place you want to be to talk about it during the next hour, where today we're going to spend some time discussing how satellites are made, prepared for launch and operated, checked out in orbit, with the help of some kind folks from the Boeing Company, which makes, among many other things, the GPS navigation spacecraft that it seems we now all can't live without. We'll also update you with the new launch date for the next launch from the Cape, and we'll round out the program with our new space-related question and answer feature, Terminal Count. Plus, I'd very much welcome your questions and comments today about anything having to do with our space program, past, present, or future. Give us a call anytime during the program today. 321-768-1240 is the phone number, or if you'd prefer to send us an email, the address is spacetalking@aol.com. We're going to get to my official commentary for the week in a moment, but I think it is important to say that, well, here we are on the weekend before the big election. I don't know about you, but I can't wait to vote this Tuesday. I hope all of you are planning to make your voice heard if you haven't already. Today is the last day for early voting here in Brevard, and of course you can still send in your absentee ballot, as I am proud to say one of my sons did this week, which was very responsible of him, I might add. On this program dedicated to all topics concerning our space program, we have spent a lot of time during the past few weeks talking about what each of the presidential candidates have said or not said about space, and I think I've made it pretty clear that, at least in my opinion, neither President Obama nor Governor Romney have overwhelmed me with any particular grand vision or words of commitment and support for our space exploration program. I also think that NASA is going to be okay no matter who wins. We'll talk more about that later in the program in the weeks to come. I've made my decision, of course, based on all the issues I care about, not just the single issue of space, so I certainly recommend you do the same. In any case, again, we'll know here in a week or so what's going to happen. So anyway, with those thoughts out of the way, I do want to invite you to listen to this week's broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. Space Shuttle Atlantis arrived at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex on Friday after a day-long parade through the streets of America's Rocket Ranch that concluded with an unforgettable evening fireworks display. 8 years after the decision was made to end the shuttle program, at long last, Enterprise, Discovery, Endeavor, and now Atlantis all are delivered to what can only be described, for better or worse, as their final resting place. Now, there's still plenty of work ahead to get Atlantis ready for public display at the visitor complex, and when completed and opened in July of next year, I have no doubt we'll be able to claim bragging rights as having the best of the nation's orbiter exhibits. Atlantis will be mounted off the floor at an angle, wheels up, its payload bay doors open, appearing just as it did when it flew in space and racked up more than 125 million miles during its 33 space flights. It's going to be an impressive sight that will thrill visitors to the Space Center for years to come. Now, among all of us who have been so close to the shuttle program, seeing Atlantis there will continue to evoke those bittersweet feelings that combine our pride and love of this grand lady of space with a sense of disappointment and sadness, perhaps, that it all ended too soon, that we should have had a replacement vehicle ready to go to continue carrying our astronauts into space from our own shores and not from the foreign steppes of Kazakhstan. Now, many of those bittersweet emotions were expressed by the folks that gathered at KSC on Friday to watch Atlantis pass by. But mostly, it seemed to me, The overwhelming sense coming from the crowds who were there was of excitement and support for our space program and its future. Once again, as we saw with Discovery in Washington and with Endeavor in California, there is more public support for our space program, more instinctual desire present to explore strange new worlds than the polls and many of our elected leaders would have us otherwise believe. Now, I think this was shown even more strongly on Friday when you consider that many of the thousands who watched Atlantis pass by did so as part of their vacations to Central Florida and had paid admission to the visitor complex to be taken by special bus to an exclusive viewing area where they could meet astronauts and see displays showcasing what the future of human spaceflight will look like. Now, not to change the subject here, but Atlantis's move and all the pomp and circumstance that went with it is something I wish space jumper Felix Baumgartner could have seen. A few weeks after jumping from a balloon 24 miles up and becoming the first man to break the sound barrier while falling, the daring Austrian made some disappointing comments about space exploration a few days ago during an interview with the British newspaper The Telegraph. Now, you'd think a guy who has such a spirit of adventure about him and who, to secure his own place in history, relied on so much space-age technology that came directly or indirectly from the space program, would just naturally embrace a pro-space mindset. But you would be wrong. Here's what he said. A lot of guys, they are talking about landing on Mars because they say it is so important to land on Mars because we would learn a lot more about our planet here, our Earth, by going to Mars, which actually makes no sense to me because we know a lot about Earth and we still treat our planet, which is very fragile, in a really bad way. He said, so I think we should perhaps spend all the money which is going to Mars to learn about Earth. I mean, you cannot send people there because it is just too far away. That little knowledge we get from Mars, I don't think it does make sense. He added, this is tax money. People should decide, are you willing to spend all this money to go to Mars? He says, I think the average person on the ground would never spend that much amount of money. They have to spend it on something that makes sense, and this is definitely saving our planet. Okay, do we really need to break down his comments? It doesn't make sense to study Mars because we're mistreating our own planet? Felix, do you think we might just possibly learn how to treat our planet better by also understanding how Mars became a planet-sized desert in the first place? It doesn't make sense to send people to Mars because it is too far away? Really? Well, Felix, it wasn't so long ago that people were saying you were crazy to take a balloon as far up as you did and jump. For that matter, it wasn't so long ago that people said we couldn't fly across the ocean because it was too far, let alone travel to the moon. And don't get me started on the whole deal about spending money in space. The only money that has ever gone into space has been the few dollars and coins astronauts have taken up as souvenirs. The rest of it has all been spent right here on Earth. And oh, although you are an Austrian and should really be more concerned about where your country is spending your tax dollars, I would remind you that while billions of dollars are in fact spent by NASA each year, and yes, it's more money than any of us will ever see in our own, the amount is still a drop in the bucket for such a rich nation like ours. And even at that, unfortunately, NASA's budget is still less than Americans spend each year on such things as cosmetics, junk food, or even professional sports. So, Felix, I've changed my mind about you. A few weeks ago, I applauded your feat of daring do and the company that supported you. Now, not so much. All I can say is that I hope that the next time you plan to make a big leap from on high, you might consider parachuting into the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex next year so you can see Atlantis in all her glory, meet some of the folks who work here, and perhaps become more educated, enlightened, and excited about the value of space exploration. Otherwise, as far as I'm concerned, Felix, you can just go jump in a lake. And that's this week's Orbital Inclinations. Well, you know them, you love them, you can't live without them. They're the GPS navigation satellites that orbit our planets, and that's the topic for the rest of the program today. Boeing's Harry Brown and Sherry Berner will join us in just a moment. Do please stay tuned. I'm Jim Behnke, and you are listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240. The number to call to participate in the program today. You can also send your questions or comments in an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. By the way, do invite you to check out the Space Talk page at WMMBAM.com. We have some exclusive pictures of Atlantis's move on Friday by our photographer friend Mark Uziak. He just sent me a bunch more from last night just before I came to the studio, and I'll have them posted for you later today. Some great memories of what happened out at KSC here yesterday to save and treasure and put as your desktop, screen tops, and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, hey, you know, I remember back in the good old days of the early space shuttle program, there was kind of an ongoing sentiment within the orbiter processing hangars. It was meant as a joke, but I think there was some ring of truth to it, that no one really cared about what the shuttle was carrying. What really mattered was when the shuttle itself was ready to fly, and it better not have to wait for any payload to be ready. Now, maybe there's still a little hint of that attitude today. Perhaps we spend so much time, at least on this program, talking about rockets and launch operations around here, we often forget to think about much about what those vehicles are actually carrying into orbit and what those satellites mean for us here on Earth. I guarantee you that my two guests today know all about what the rocket is carrying, especially because, well, sometimes usually it's a satellite they were responsible for building and launching, and all of us are realizing more and more that we just can't live without. Harry Brown is chief engineer for the company's GPS program in California, Boeing. He is joining us by phone today, and Sherry Berner is Boeing's manager charge of all the company's satellite operations here on the Space Coast. And as a local, she is with us here in the studio today. First, Sherry, welcome aboard.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you there. Just don't forget to be as close to your mic as possible. And Harry, on the phone, how are you out there in California today, sir?
Oh, I'm doing great, Jim, and it's a pleasure being here and talking about GPS.
Well, can't wait to do it. Harry, let's start with you as the chief engineer, the Scotty of the Boeing program, or maybe you've heard that before, I'm sure. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you, with a quick bio, how did you wind up where you're at today, and why are you interested in the space program?
Oh, I love the space program. It started back when my mom and dad woke me up to watch the Apollo landing, and I go, that's something I've just got to do. I've got to get involved in space. So I've been in the space business for about 35 years.
Wow. So it was really just that early stuff, and you an engineer the whole time?
Yes, I started off on the shuttle program. I've worked a number of satellite programs, and for the last 14 years, I've worked GPS.
And Sherry, here at the Cape, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved in the space program? Why are you interested?
Well, I wanted to be an astronaut when I was about 10 years old.
Yeah.
I think it started with Lost in Space. That's probably dating me a little
bit. No, really? wrong channel. I was a Star Trek guy myself, but that's okay.
Of course, then it went to Star Trek and all that. But I've always been interested in space. And knew I wanted, if I couldn't be an astronaut, wanted to be part of the space program. Started on working in Huntsville, Alabama with the Payload Crew Training Complex. We would train all the space lab astronauts on
the
experiments.
Sure, on Space Lab, yeah.
Then I moved to Space Station and Sea Launch, and I've been on GPS for coming on 5 years now.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that Huntsville was such a home for payload operations
as opposed
to always rocket engines. And Sea Launch, too, that amazes me. That's the rocket that goes out into the South Pacific, launches off of a barge, if you will, and a very successful program. It's had its ups and downs, but it's just been a great, great story. And you've been on those trips to the South Pacific?
Yes, actually, I've done 28 launches on
Sea Launch. Wow. What was your first, what was the tradition when you crossed the equator, or did you cross the equator?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
The Neptune ceremony.
The Neptune ceremony? Do we need to talk about it anymore?
No, I think what happens on board
on
boat stays
on board. On the ambassador, whatever. So, okay, well, Harry, let's talk about satellites in general. You know, we know that they're up there. We don't want to talk about orbital mechanics and all that, but I am curious, you know, how do you make a satellite? And what goes into that as sort of a high-level description?
So, Jim, we make our satellites here in the Satellite Development Center over in El Segundo. It's actually the largest satellite manufacturing facility in the world, about 1 million square feet. And we essentially, for GPS, instituted what we call a pulse line, in which we're actually building the satellites similar to the aircraft and helicopter business. In fact, that's where we got it from, in which we move the satellite from work center to work center, and we leave the employees at that particular work center to be more efficient. We don't travel work. We start with vehicle assembly, basically putting our boxes on the panels. We do integrated testing on the panels, then bring those panels together in a bus configuration and do environmental testing on the bus, and including thermal vacuum test. And then we do final integrated system test and package it to be shipped to the Cape.
But now these satellites, you know, I mean, you're not pumping out 1,000 of these things like a Ford assembly line. I wonder to what extent are these literally handcrafted still, or do we pretty much understand what we got to do, and it's just a lot of soldering and bending metal?
There's a lot of engineering involved in this, and a lot of testing, simulations, extensive amount of simulations. But to from the time that we get all of the components available to integrate a satellite until it goes through our pulse line is roughly about 4 to 5 months, roughly.
From the time metal is first bent, the first part is delivered to the factory, to 4 months or so later, you've got a satellite ready to fly.
That's correct. Now, there's a lot of development work that happens well before that. In fact, years of development work. But once we've actually got the hardware in place, actually putting the satellite together and getting it out of the factory is pretty routine now.
Well, and talk a little bit about your team out there. How many people and what kind of skill sets do they have? What kind of people are they?
We have roughly about 250 to 300 people, including, you know, engineering, manufacturing folks who are known for integrating things. We have guys who are responsible for materials and processes that essentially look at the space environment and determine how the satellite parts have to respond to that. And then, of course, we have our normal technicians that are actually doing the nuts and bolts of putting the satellite together.
So are we thinking rocket scientists here? Are we all in white smocks and bunny suits with a laid-back California attitude?
So we actually build our satellites in a clean room environment. And our high bay is about 1,000 times cleaner than your typical household.
Wow. So once you've built these satellites, and we'll talk about GPS more particular in a few moments, but once you build it, then, Harry, when do you hand it off to Sherry? Who's responsible for getting it here, and how does it get here? Which one of you is the better one for that?
So, Harry, what we do is once we've configured and did our final testing and close out of the satellite, then Sherry's team comes to El Segundo and picks it up. And Sherry, you can tell them the route to the Cape.
Big truck and a long trap over Route 66? Or
No, we have a special shipping container that we place the satellite in. It goes to LAX, and it travels here on a C-17.
On a C-17?
Correct, an Air Force plane.
Plenty of room, one per plane kind of a
one
thing?
One per plane. Of course, then it comes with all of its support equipment that we need that we don't keep here.
So it flies across country, one nonstop, first class and
one,
all that?
One nonstop. We put some people on board to make sure that it travels in style.
Sure.
It lands here at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station.
At the skid strip?
At the skid strip.
Okay.
And we offload it there. We put it on a specially built truck, and we drive it over to where we're located on Cape Canaveral Air Station. It's called Area 59, for those who are local might know that. We offload it in the Navstar processing facility, get it out of the container, get it into a test stand, and then we continue the processing that was started in the factory.
And how soon or how long does it take from the time it arrives here, or how soon do you want it before you're scheduled for a target launch date?
We target 90 days.
90 days, really?
Yes.
So, not and Harry, and I don't know which one of you again now, when we start talking about, well, let's take the finish the story, Sherry. Once it's integrated onto the rocket, you're lifting it at the pad. Is that still how that's done here?
Yes. Well, we encapsulate. We work. We can launch either on a Delta or an Atlas. We will, after we're fueled, we'll mate to either to the booster hardware,
okay.
And then they will transport it to us to the pad, and then lift us to whichever booster we're going to be traveling.
So I suppose in the case of the Delta IV, which is assembled horizontally and lifted, do you get lifted at the pad?
We get lifted at the pad,
and then with the Atlas, of course,
we get lifted in the
assembly facility, and then
correct.
And then rolled
and then
out.
Then we're rolled to the pad.
And then with about 30 seconds here, crazy day for launch. You guys sit back, turn it all on, and watch it fly?
No, we start about 8 hours before launch, coming on console, and we configure the satellite. And the last probably 90 minutes are the most tense.
I can't even imagine. And then we'll talk about the launch and getting to that moment of spacecraft separation as well here, which is also a nail butter. Hey, everybody, we're going to pause for our five-minute built-in hold here at the bottom of the hour. Get you all caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. Again, as College Football Saturday continues on a beautiful November weekend here on the Space Coast, do stay tuned. I'm Jim Benke. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk here on WMMB. Our phone lines and online inbox open for your questions or comments. The phone number 321-768-1240. The email address is spacetalking@aol.com. Before we continue our conversation about Boeing and the work they're doing on the GPS satellite program, I want to be sure and let you know that the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation, based here at the Cape, is having its 10th annual online auction right now. And today, in fact, is the final day to bid. More than 50 lots of astronaut-related items, including autographs, stuff that's flown in space, and opportunities to spend some quality time one-on-one with some astronauts. We're talking about skydiving, golfing, scuba diving, all up for bid. Proceeds of the whole action here to help fund scholarships that go to college students who promise to make a big difference in our space program in the future. The Astronaut Scholarship Foundation, a first-class organization run by Lynn LeBlanc, and while I'm not particularly endorsing any candidate for election, I can wholeheartedly recommend you support this very important fundraising event. Again, bid on items online at astronautscholarship.org. Today is the last chance, and good luck to all of you. With us here in the studio, Sherry Berner is the site manager for Boeing Satellite Operations here at the Cape. On the phone from California is Harry Brown, who's the GPS program engineer for Boeing. And before we went to our bottom of the hour break, Sherry, we were talking about the whole satellite flow. It was back to you. We're counting down to launch. You're the site manager. Your team responsible for getting this thing ready to go. And it goes. Is it out of your hands at that point?
Basically, yes. Once the engine's on the booster light, it's the brake wires go, and then we wait with bated breath until spacecraft's up and it's picked up by the ground stations.
And then Harry, does the story go back to you then and your team out west? At some point, does Boeing check this thing out on orbit before turning it officially over to the Air Force?
Oh, that's correct, Jim. We have a team in Colorado Springs that supports the Air Force in the on-orbit checkout. And, oh, by the way, also, we are responsible for the operational control segment that actually controls the Constellation and performs that checkout in terms of command and control and mission data. So once it's launched and the vehicle is doing its injection, we're monitoring it, we wait for separation, and then the team then starts the process of doing the on-orbit checkout.
And what's involved with that? Is that deploying solar arrays, battery power, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so the first thing that happens is we actually get the booster to, after we come off the booster, we have to de-spin the satellite, because during the launch ascent, we try to get maximum sun on the arrays, so we actually get like a 5 RPM rotation on the satellite. So we reduce that to about a half an RPM. Then we deploy the solar arrays and any of the deployable antennas. The first thing we do is we acquire Earth using our Earth sensors, and once we've done that, then we're off jets, and we're on reaction wheels, and we go to three-axis stabilization. Because we're using a Delta and an Atlas ELV vehicle, they actually put us in what we call the final orbit. It's a drift orbit that allows us to drift to our final position, as opposed to in the old days where we actually had to do a Hohmann transfer orbit to get to our position. So we allow the vehicle to drift to its proper location, and while it's drifting, we then turn on the avionics, we start letting the vehicle do its outgassing, and we then start turning on our payloads, powering them up, verifying that the payloads are okay, and the whole process typically is about 30 days. However, for this last launch that we just did in October, we were successful in completing that in 22 days.
So is that a mark of just the efficiency of being able to do it, or did more things go right this time than maybe on previous?
It was everything going right, and also some efficiencies that are built in.
Now, Harry, talk a little bit more about the GPS spacecraft itself. We don't need to talk about how it actually works, but you've got a set of signals coming down, and there's triangulation and all that. But I guess the thing I want to talk about is how these spacecraft have evolved over the years. I remember the first major one after the test series going up in 89 on that new Delta II rocket. The satellites have changed over the course of the years. They've gotten bigger, more, better. I mean, I don't even know how to describe it. Can you talk about what these satellites that Boeing is making right now, how they're kind of better and different than before?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, let me just say that, you know, Boeing's been a prime contractor and a partner with the Air Force for almost four decades. So we built the first original Block 1, the Block 2As, and, of course, now the 2F, which is a follow-on. And so as the satellites have progressed, you know, the new 2F satellites bring some additional signals for the warfighter that gives us anti-jamming. They also bring some second signals for the Department of Transportation, the FAA. Essentially, the satellites have pretty much doubled in weight. The current 2F satellite weighs about 3,600 pounds. It's about the size of a Volkswagen before the arrays are deployed. And then with the arrays deployed, it's about the size of a AH-64 helicopter.
So as they're getting better, you talk about these additional signals, and you know, I remember in the early days, whether how much, you know, the Department of Defense, the Air Force would even let civilians use GPS and how accurate it would be. But, you know, I mean, driving the latest cars with the latest gadgets on it, you know, I mean, it's we're like right down to where, I mean, it just nails exactly where we are. Even on my iPhone, you know, the button's pushing exactly right where I am at. Is there that much more accuracy? I mean, how is the military signal? I mean, I don't know what to extent you can talk about it, but how much more is the military signal, for example, that much better than the civilian signal?
It's quite a bit better than the civil signal, and it has a lot more anti-jamming properties. But the civilian signal, it's actually improving on every build that we've done. The advances in the 2F satellite is basically going to lead our constellation, the GPS constellation, and the users for the next 12 to 15 years. There's capabilities out there that we have not even explored yet.
So let's talk about some of the other systems out there. GPS is clearly the utility, and I'll ask you guys in a minute about how maybe each of you use GPS in your daily lives and work lives, But Harry, there's other systems up there. I know that Japan's working on something. Russian certainly has a navigation system up there. The Chinese just recently launched their next set, or I don't know, next satellite or two of what their plan is supposed to be. Do we need all these navigation? Are they all up there doing different things? Can we all use them? I mean, how do you guys look at that? Is this a big competition too?
We don't believe it's a competition. You know, accurate position, timing, and navigation is needed for the world. And so we don't look at the GLONASS and the other systems as being a competition. In fact, there are conferences that go on to talk about how we can get those signals all incorporated to basically give us better information on the ground. The one thing that's coming up is there's going to be an international signal, the L1C, which is going to be available for all users, and it'll combine both the Galileo and the GPS constellations.
Sherry, let's talk about the GPS. I mean, you sit here as the site manager, you watch this thing, you see the satellite come in, and you watch it launch, and you know how important it is to really our entire nation. I mean, this has become an information utility that we can't get along without, it seems. You watch the TV show Revolution, I don't know if you've seen it, but where all the power goes off and we live, you know, like we might have lived 200-300 years ago. I don't know how we could get along without GPS. Do you have what's your sense of, first of all, how do you use it in your life and maybe at work? Do you even use your own GPS signal to get your GPS satellite ready to fly? And what do you think about that? I mean, I guess the question is, how do you feel about all this?
I think it's become so commonplace that people don't even think about it anymore. If you use an ATM, you turn your cell phones on, you make any type of bank transaction, that's all GPS-based. So people don't – it's so commonplace, it's not even a thought process in people other than probably when they're punching in an address into their GPS in their car because they want to go somewhere, and that's an action that they have to physically take.
But when you see that GPS signal in your car and you think, oh, my gosh, I put that satellite in orbit.
Yes, I do.
I feel the same way when I watch my DirecTV and my Minnesota Viking game. I can't believe I have a dish on my roof that points to a satellite that's receiving the signal. And it's the same way with GPS. You know, I just can't. And Harry, I don't know, maybe you can talk about it. This thing about ATM, we always talk about ATMs using GPS. And it's not like we're keeping track of where our money is going. But it's really the timing, isn't it?
That's correct. It's the timing. It allows transactions all over the world to take place because of the precision timing. GPS employs atomic clocks that give very, very accurate timing.
And so that means because we got to know what time we have enough money in the account versus what time money is going out of the account that we don't overdraft or something. I assume that's
absolutely an
oversimplification. Hey, Harry, how do you use GPS out there? I mean, boy, California, I don't know how you get along without it on all those freeways.
It's certainly used for the freeways, but it also, you know, it's got so many different uses. You know, in California, GPS is used for surveying for earthquakes. I mean, we know exactly how far the earth has shifted based on GPS position. You know, there's a lot of farmers in California who use it for precision agriculture. It basically improves their crop yield because they know exactly where to fertilize and where not to fertilize. So it's used throughout, as Sherry was speaking before. And, of course, you know, LAX being one of the busiest airlines in the world, if without the GPS equipment, you wouldn't be able to get as many flights in the LAX as safely and efficiently as you would.
That's absolutely right. Hey, Harry, we're going to stand by here. We're going to take our final break. And when we come back, Harry and Sherry are participate in our new feature, Terminal Count. We'll learn a little bit more about them. In the meantime, we'll be right back in a moment. I'm Jim Benke. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk with your reminder that you can stay in touch with us online throughout the week. Your first stop, WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk. You can find an archive of past Space Talk shows and text versions of our orbital inclinations. You also can follow us on Twitter at Space Talking, and we have a Space Talk page on Facebook where your questions or comments are always welcome. We're going to be joined back by Harry Brown and Sherry Berner from Boeing here in just a moment. By the way, Paula from Boeing listening in from Public Affairs, just want to say you almost did a great job. You didn't tell me that Sherry is a Green Bay Packers fan, born and raised in Wisconsin, and so we've just had an interesting conversation about the Vikings and the Packers. We'll let it go this time. Hey, now as we take a look, we're going to find out when we might expect the next launch from Cape Canaveral. We find that still yet again the shot has been delayed more than 2 weeks since we updated you last Saturday. Launch of the next X-37B orbital test vehicle on a United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket, now targeted to fly November 27th. The delays are coming because of the Air Force and ULA say they need more time to fully understand what happened during a Delta IV launch on October 4th, which I think, as we alluded to earlier, launched the most recent GPS satellite into orbit. Now, of course, the satellite did arrive in its proper orbit just fine. It's working great. But there was a problem with the Delta IV's Centaur upper stage that everyone would just as soon not see happen again. And since both the Atlas V and Delta IV use what is essentially the same type of second stage on its rocket, officials don't want to proceed with launching the next of either booster until they understand what the problem is and correct it. So once again, all that said, and until everything is sorted out, we'll keep November 27th penciled in as the date, and we'll keep you up to date, of course, throughout. For more information about this and all the various other launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keywords Space Talk, and look for the link to our local launch forecast. All right, in our remaining moments here with the, I hate to say it, the Harry and Sherry Show. Isn't that something? We could start something new here. It is time for Terminal Count, our new feature at the end of Space Talk, in which we will ask five simple questions of our guests to get to know them better. This is not a quiz. There are no right or wrong answers. And please, as always at home, no wagering. All right, Harry and Sherry, let's start it out. Sherry, coolest rocket?
Shuttle.
Shuttle, absolutely.
Absolutely.
No doubt about
it. Hands down.
Really, even with all your GPS going up on the different kind of rockets, huh?
Yeah, but there's nothing like the sight and the feel and the sound of a, especially in person, of a shuttle.
Oh, that's right. Harry Brown, coolest rocket?
I agree, space shuttle. Yeah, it's had 135 launches, so absolutely.
Very good. All right, Sherry, first launch you saw or remember?
Probably my first shuttle launch. I brought my nephew down here when he was 7, and we got to see it in person. Got a couple
passes
to get out to there, and watching it with him through his eyes, I remember that more than the ones I watched on TV.
Yeah, isn't that amazing to see someone watch one for the first time?
Right.
It's almost always a tear shed. Harry, what about you? The first launch that you saw or remember?
The first launch I actually experienced was a Titan IV. Out of the Cape.
Really? How close were you?
Pretty close.
Were you supporting a launch for that one, or you just happened to be in town?
I was actually supporting a launch, and the feel of that Titan IV leaving the pad is just it just brings chills through you.
I remember as a reporter, we were for the first Titan IV launch, we were put on the blockhouse at Complex 34. And it was only after that launch that Range Safety realized we were probably too close.
Too close.
That was something else. I'll never forget that. Okay, Sherry, most prized space memorabilia?
I have a pin or a patch from every single launch that I have participated in. And
oh,
I've
that's
got
cool.
I've got it on a streamer, so I'm collecting them and hope to collect quite a few more.
Some of the GPS patches have been pretty creative.
Yes, they have.
Through the years. How about you, Harry? The most prized piece of space memorabilia you own?
I've actually got a single board computer, which basically is the avionics for our GPS satellites. It actually is the brain.
Oh, really? Okay, and that sits on your shelf? Looking good, huh?
It's encased in glass and
oh, really?
On my shelf.
Oh, that's neat. Okay, Sherry, best space TV series or movie?
Star Trek, but the Next Generation.
Star Trek Next Generation,
yes.
TV series. Okay, mm-hmm. That's a good answer. That's a fair answer. Harry, how about you? Best space TV
series? I'm an old-time Star Trek fan.
Star Trek, the original series, huh?
The original Star Trekies.
Are you looking forward to the new movie coming out next year?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Star Trek Into Darkness, I understand. Okay, Sherry. Moon, Mars, or beyond?
Beyond.
Beyond?
Yeah, I think, we've grown up on all these TV shows and Star Wars where they explore the galaxies. Maybe it's a fantasy, but I think we just need to keep going.
Keep going no matter what.
Right.
Harry, how about you? Moon, Mars, or beyond?
Mars. I think our next mission ought to be to Mars.
Really? Do you think we need to go back to the moon first?
No,
to Mars.
We've done the moon. I think we ought to go straight for Mars.
And once we get to Mars, let me ask you this as the chief engineer. When do we start putting in the navigation system above Mars, and how soon will we need it?
Oh, I would say that's probably going to take another few years.
Another few years. Don't they use the satellites, the Mars orbiters, the various orbiting Mars? I mean, maybe you don't know about it, to help triangulate the position of the rovers on the ground. Maybe it's more done photographically than it is with electronics, but it seemed to me that there was some useful utility there. I don't know if you, that's crossed
your
desk.
That's correct. My wife actually worked the Mars rover program.
Oh, did she really? And did she work Curiosity as well?
I don't think she worked Curiosity.
Okay. Oh, that's good stuff anyway. Well, look, hey, Sherry Berner, Harry Brown, again, thank you so much for being on the program today. We're going to start wrapping up. GPS, we can't live without it, and we appreciate so much. Harry, what you guys do out there in the West to get it ready. Sherry, to bring it here and launch it. Great to have you as part of the Space Coast family, and good luck for the next one, whenever that may be.
Thank you very much.
Harry, thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you, Jim. It was a pleasure.
We'll talk again. And Paula, I know you're listening, and thanks for your help to do. We'll talk to you and follow up here later. Okay, there goes Harry Brown, Sherry Berner from Boeing GPS. As we close off the program here next week on Space Talk, we'll be joined by the winners of this year's Harry Colcomb News and Communications Award from the National Space Club Florida Committee. The 2012 honorees include Sid Champagne, longtime videographer for WFTV Channel 9, and Emily Perry, the director of the Air Force Space and Missile Museum out at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, and one of Brevard's best-kept secrets. I'm talking about the museum, not Emily. Both of them incredibly deserving the honor, great contributors to our space community, and we'll talk to all of them here next week. Don't forget to vote this week, and we'll offer some thoughts about the results of the election as well. That is all for now. Space Talk, a production of Myla Solutions, brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the op station for today's program. Please join us next Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's right, not daylight time, Standard Time. Turn your clocks back an hour tonight for another hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of the Glenn Beck program. I'm Jim Bankey, and we'll talk to you again real soon.